which this week consists of Exodus chapter 6, verse 2, through Exodus chapter 7, verse 7, and then the Haftarah, Ezekiel chapter 28, verse 25, through 29, verse 21, and Isaiah 42, verse 8. And then our psalm reading is Psalm 44, and from the Brit Hadashah, 3 John, verses 1 through 8, and Revelation chapter 3, verse 7, through verse 13, and Revelation chapter 14, and verse 1. So let's begin by looking at Exodus in chapter 6, beginning in verse 2. And Elohim spoke unto Moshe and said, I am Yahweh. And I appeared unto Abraham and unto Isaac and unto Jacob by the name of El Shaddai. But by my name Yahweh was I not known to them. And I have also established my covenant with them to give them the land of Canaan, the land of their pilgrimage wherein they were strangers. Let's stop right there, because we just had an in-depth teaching earlier on Yeshua being Yahweh. And here we have Yeshua, the Redeemer, who is and appears to Moses, and he shares that he revealed himself and appeared to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, revealing the name El Shaddai, but by the name Yahweh was he not known to them. There's a very important principle of the Torah, and that is, what we read in the Torah is actually all a parable. Psalm 78, verses 1 and 2. And it's all prophetic to teach you about Yeshua, the Messiah, and the principles and ways of the kingdom of Yahweh. So, here the setting is that the children of Israel are about to be redeemed based upon Yahweh Yeshua keeping his to Abraham. And the principle of what is being shown here is the link between the redeeming of the children of Israel on behalf of the covenant made with Abraham and the Redeemer revealing himself to his people regarding who he is. This is prophetic that the Messiah, when he ultimately gathers the exiles of Israel during the Great Tribulation, that it will be at that time that he will be revealing to his people that he's gathering that Yeshua is not only the Messiah, but he is also Yahweh. So we see this being foreshadowed right here in Exodus in chapter 6. Now what's interesting is that the gematria of the name of the God of Israel, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, is 26. And Moses is being called upon to be a deliverer on behalf of the one who's going to fulfill his covenant with Abraham. And Abraham is the 26th generation from Adam. So in the 26th generation, he's revealing his name, which has a numerical value of 26. Yes, and it says in Exodus chapter 6 and verse 5, I have also heard the groaning of the children of Israel, whom the Egyptians keep in bondage, and I have remembered my covenant. Wherefore say unto the children of Israel, I am Yahweh, and I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians, and I will rid you out of their bondage, and I will redeem you with a stretched out arm and with great judgments. And I will take you to me for a people, and I will be to you a God, and you will know that I am Yahweh your Elohim, which brings you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. So I will take you to me for a people. That's a prophetic allusion that when the Messiah gathers the exiles of Israel, he will make them his people. And he will be their Elohim, which is what is associated with the renewed covenant. It says, Jeremiah 31:31, Behold, the days come, says Yahweh, that I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. Verse 33, But this will be the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel. After those days, says Yahweh, I will put my Torah in their inward parts, write it in their hearts, and look, I will be their Elohim and they will be my people. So the one that's making a new covenant with his people says, I'm going to take you to be a people unto me and I will be their God. The one that's making a new covenant with them is going to be their God. So in Matthew, in chapter 26, Matthew chapter 26, verse 28, it says, For this is the blood of the New Testament, or the New Covenant, which is shed for many for the remission of sins. So when Yeshua died on the tree, he took unto himself a people. And the people that he took would recognize that he is their God, that he is Yahweh Elohim. And it says in Exodus 6:6, And I will redeem you with the stretched out arm and with great judgments. We read verse 7. I will take you to me for a people, and I will be to you a God, and you will know that I am Yahweh your Elohim, which brings you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. So it says, and you will know that I am Yahweh your Elohim when I do this. Well, when the Messiah gathers the exiles of Israel in the end of days, they will know who the one is that redeems them. They will know that Yeshua is the Messiah. They will know that Yeshua is Yahweh. In Zechariah chapter 14, verse 9, it says, And Yahweh will be king over all the earth. In that day there will be one Yahweh, and his name one. In Ezekiel chapter 39, which is a chapter regarding Gog and Magog, it says that when Yahweh defeats the Gog-Magog forces, he goes on to say in Ezekiel 39:22, So the house of Israel will know that I am Yahweh their Elohim from that day forward. From that day forward, they will know that I am Yahweh, their Elohim. Who's the one speaking here? It's Yahweh Yeshua. From this moment, they will know that Yeshua is the Messiah and that he is Yahweh Elohim. Which means before Gog Magog, his people didn't know that he was Yahweh their Elohim. But they will know from that day forward. Now, notice they're going to know that he's Yahweh their Elohim. He's going to know who Yah. They're going to know when Yahweh is, when he defeats his enemies, and what it's associated with gathering the exiles of Israel. Ezekiel 39:25. Therefore, thus says Yahweh Elohim, now will I bring again the captivity of Jacob and have mercy on the whole house of Israel, and I will be jealous for my holy name. Now, in Ezekiel chapter 37, where we have the account of the dry bones, it says in Ezekiel 37:11, Son of man, these bones are the whole house of Israel. And it says in verse 12, Therefore prophesy and say unto them, Thus says Yahweh Elohim, Behold, O my people, I will open your graves and cause you to come up out of your graves, and I will bring you into the land of Israel. That's gathering the exiles of Israel. Notice what this is associated with. And you will know that I am Yahweh when I've opened your graves. They will know that who's Yahweh. They will know, the Jews believe that the Messiah is going to gather the exiles of Israel. But they don't know that Yeshua is the Messiah. They don't know that he's Yahweh. So when he does that, that's when he's going to be revealed as the Messiah and going to be revealed as Yahweh. And there's another verse. You will know that I am Yahweh when I've opened your graves, O my people, and brought you up out of your graves. Then, we can see how the Torah and the Exodus from Egypt prophesies and foreshadows that in the gathering of the greater Exodus from all the nations of the world, that the theme that's linked with redeeming his people on behalf of the covenant made with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob is revealing to the people he's redeeming that he's Yahweh. Now notice, in order for the full revelation of that Yeshua is Yahweh, it takes both the first coming of Yeshua and the second coming of Yeshua. And this is alluded to in the name of Yahweh himself. The Yod represents the hand. It means to stretch out and to save. The deliverance of Yahweh is what the Yod represents. Yod Hey. The He is the Hebrew letter that brings glory to something. When Abram's name was changed from Abram to Abraham, there was a He added. From Sarai to Sarah, a He was added. So, Yeshua has a glory from his first coming. That's the first He. And he has a glory from his second coming. But the glory from his second coming is greater than the glory of his first coming. But in order to see that he's Yahweh, it takes the first coming, the Yod and the He, the first coming, and the Vav. Vav means and in Hebrew. So it takes the first coming, Vav, and He, the second coming, the glory of the second coming. It's the Yod, it's revealing himself with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm in the first coming and the second coming. But also the Vav in Hebrew means a nail. So you have the first coming and him dying on the tree, the nail, and the second coming. So this is all alluded to in Exodus chapter 6, that thematically, with the redeeming of his people from Egypt, is the revelation of the one who's doing the redeeming. Ultimately, Yeshua the Messiah. And so Exodus chapter 6 verse 8, I will bring you in unto the land concerning the which I did swear to give to Abraham, to Isaac, and Jacob, and I will give it to you for a heritage or for an inheritance. You see, the redemption of his people is associated with bringing his people to a promised land. That's what happened at the first coming. That's what happens at the second coming. It's to bring his people, return them back to the land of Israel or Zion. And when he brings them back at the second coming, at the Messianic era, those who he brings back the land, he's giving the land as an inheritance. Now, regarding the giving of the land as an inheritance in the end of days, let's look at Ezekiel in chapter 47. What if you are not physically descended from one of the 12 tribes, and he gathers you back to the land? It says in Ezekiel 47 verse 21, so shall you divide this land unto you according to the tribes of Israel. And it will come to pass that you will divide it by lot for an inheritance unto you, and the strangers that sojourn among you, which shall beget children among you, and they shall be unto you as born in the country among the children of Israel. They will have an inheritance with you among the tribes of Israel. And it will come to pass that in what tribe the stranger sojourns, there shall you give him his inheritance. So we have the strangers who are not physically descended from the 12 tribes of Israel, that when they participate in the redemption, they have an inheritance with the tribe that they end up sojourning with. So we have this principle that when Yahweh redeems his people from Egypt, that he does so by bringing his people into a promised land and giving them an inheritance. Verse 9, and Moses spoke so unto the children of Israel, but they hearkened not unto Moses for anguish of spirit and for cruel bondage. And Yahweh spoke unto Moses, saying, speak unto Paro, king of Egypt, that he let the children of Israel go out of the land. And Moshe spoke before Yahweh, saying, behold, the children of Israel have not hearkened unto me. How then shall Pharaoh hear me? So the fact that the children of Israel didn't hearken unto Moses, and after initially being excited, doubted and questioned the deliverance and what was happening to them based upon their circumstances, that is a prophetic foreshadowing that when Yeshua would come as the Redeemer, they would initially be excited, but then they would question and doubt because things didn't work out circumstantially how they expected. And Yahweh gave unto Moses and Aaron and gave them charge unto the children of Israel and unto Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to bring the children of Israel out of the land of Egypt. We're going to stop there. We're going to open it up for questions, thoughts, and comments in the congregation or in Paltalk land. Bill?
I see in verse 6 and 7 the expressions here of redemption. The first cup says, I will bring you out. The second cup, I will rescue you. The third cup, I shall redeem you. And the fourth cup, I shall take you for my own. So I see a Passover experience related before it ever happened. That they give it to us here. And that's what I got out of that part there. Somebody else?
Anybody else? Thoughts, questions, comments? The congregation, on Pautauk Land, we are discussing Exodus chapter 6, verse 2 through verse 13. Anybody else with further thoughts, questions, comments? Bill?
I have a question. Did Yahweh give the land to Israel, or did he give Israel to the land?
Yes.
Yes. There you go.
Perfect answer. Yes. Verse 8 tells us, it says, I will bring you into the land concerning the which I did swear to give it to Abraham, to Yitzhak, and to Yaakov, and I will give it you for an heritage. Mm-hmm. I am Yahweh. So he gave the land to Abraham, Yitzhak, and Jacob, and then he gave Israel to the land.
I think it's interesting in this whole scenario with Moses, that how many times, like we talked about before, how many times we see excuses here for doing this. But Yahweh doesn't want excuses. Because he tells him many a times, Yahweh said, this is what I want you to do. You go to Pharaoh, you and Aaron, you go to Pharaoh, you do thus, thus, and thus. Even though he's going to say no, I still want you to do it. And he's very explicit. I wish I knew the Hebrew to some of these, the way he's expressing himself here. But he doesn't want any excuses. And I don't think that he wants those excuses from us. I think he wants us to act upon what he tells us to do. If you are seeking him and he tells you to do something, I really think we ought to do it. If we don't, okay.
I just wanted to add, Eddie took us to Ezekiel 47, 21 through 23. Mark says he doesn't know if he wants me to be meddling with him right now, but so what? Has that ever stopped me before? Where he says, if you'll want to come and live in the land, you'll be just like those who live here, my people, and you'll get the same inheritance. Now, that sounds all great and good. And it is. However, we have a problem in the faith today because people don't want that. They say they want the blessing, but they don't want to go and live in the land. And I don't just mean physically move there and get a house or an apartment and live there and do your shopping there and work there. Living in the land means living the way he wants you to live, in this case. I was listening to a friend of mine that I know from when I was in Israel the other night on God's Learning Channel, for those of you who catch that. His name was Don Harris. And he said, isn't it amazing? He was talking about the wedding parable where the father says, okay, the wedding's ready. Go out and get the people who are invited. And they didn't want to come. So go out in the highways and byways and get those people. And they came in, but there was still one man without a wedding garment, and he was cast out. Now, he says, I know how the traditional teaching goes on this, but let's put it back into context here. What's really happening? And this goes back again to Ezekiel 47, 21 to 23 that Eddie brought up. Invite the people who... Go to the people who had received the invitation. The feast is ready. The wedding feast is ready. Who were those originally? The Yehudim. They didn't want to come. So he says, we'll go out to the highways and byways. Those would be the Goyim. We know them as Ephraim and the sojourner among them. Okay? And he says, bring them in. So Ephraim and the sojourner comes in. But there's still one guy who doesn't have a wedding garment on. And the host comes over. He says, what's with this dude? That's the Teresa paraphrase. What's with this dude in his, grubby old street clothes here? Where's his wedding garment? Well, I don't know, the servant says. And the host says, cast him out of here. He's out. He doesn't belong here. Now, that sounds all fair and good. Well, why didn't he take his wedding garment? He didn't have to. The host provides the wedding garment. Just like at Yom Kippur, we wear white in type, but on that true day when that feast is fulfilled, he will give us our wedding garment. We have the choice to put them on or not. Too many people in the faith today, whether it's Sunday Christianity or even in Hebraic roots, I've heard it, I've heard it with my own two ears. People will say, but I'm not Jewish. You know what? As Don put it, it doesn't matter. Our Savior is. And He's not supposed to identify with me. I'm supposed to identify with Him. So take back to Ezekiel 47 now. If you want to come and live with my people, is what he's saying. My people implies they're living according to my ways. We got a whole lot of people who want to go back to the land, but they don't want to keep the feast, they don't want to keep the Sabbath, they don't want to give up their, you know, ham and their sausage and their bacon. They don't want to do these things.
They want to ham it up with bacon bread?
Because they'll be thinking, what will someone think of me? We're too busy wanting to hold on to our identity instead of do what Yeshua did and give up our own identity to be more like Him. To humble ourselves and empty ourselves and let Him fill us and work in us.
You know, those that don't give up their pork will be pretty soury.
One thing we see here is how many times you see with the excuses of Moses and everything like that. There's only one thing that I can say about it. I call it cold feet syndrome. Got cold feet. Can't do this. I don't want to do this. Basically, it's like, basically, I don't want to do this. You see? And every time you see what Yahweh tells them. I said, this is what I said.
Anybody else with further thoughts, questions, comments about the scriptures that we've covered so far? Exodus chapter 6, verse 2 through verse 13. Let's continue on. These be the heads of their fathers' houses, the sons of Reuben, the firstborn of Israel. And it lists some names. These are the families of Reuben. And then the sons of Simeon. And the names of the sons of Levi, the sons of Kohath, verse 18, and it says in verse 18, these are that Aaron and Moses to whom Yahweh said, bring out the children of Israel from the land of Egypt according to their armies. These are they which spake to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to bring out the children of Israel from Egypt. These are that Moses and Aaron. And it came to pass on the day when Yahweh spoke unto Moses in the land of Egypt, that Yahweh spoke unto Moses, saying, I am Yahweh, speak unto Paro, king of Mitzrayim, all that I say unto you. And Moses said before Yahweh, behold, I am of uncircumcised lips. So how shall Pharaoh hearken unto me? The answer is, Pharaoh won't hearken unto you unless you are anointed of Yahweh and you stand in that anointing and you go in Yahweh's strength and not yours. He won't listen unto you. So here, Moses at this moment starts to look at things through natural eyes instead of just plain being obedient to what Yah wants him to do. Chapter 7, verse 1, Yahweh said to Moses, see, I have made you a god to Pharaoh, and Aaron your brother shall be your prophet. So, in other words, what Yah is saying is, I'm going to elevate you and I'm going to work through you in such a way that Pharaoh is going to have the utmost respect unto you, and he will ultimately not dismiss what you have to say. I will elevate you unto him in his sight. And you know, this is also a biblical principle that if you will be obedient to Yah and not look at things through your own ability, that Yah will elevate you to accomplish your task that he's called you to do. If you will trust in him and ultimately what he sends you to do. And then it says, verse 2, you will speak all that I command you, and Aaron your brother shall speak unto Pharaoh, that he send the children of Israel out of his land. And I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and multiply my signs and wonders in the land of Egypt. Here we can understand another principle. You see, when Yah tells you to do something, it doesn't mean that all obstacles are going to go out of the way immediately, and it's going to be easy for you to accomplish and do what he wants you to do. Because the principle is, the word of Yahweh must be tried. It must be tried. Yeshua told a parable of the sower that sows the word, that affliction and persecution will arise for the word's sake. It is to test the word in our heart. But notice, ultimately, the testing is for the purpose of Yahweh getting greater glory when he accomplishes and fulfills his word, because it says, I will multiply my signs and wonders in the land of Egypt. But Paro will not hearken unto you, that I may lay my hand upon Egypt and bring forth my armies and my people and the children of Israel out of the land of Egypt by great judgment. And the Egyptians will know that I am Yahweh. Notice that when Yahweh redeems his people, not only is he being revealed to his people, but he's being revealed to his enemies as well. You see this principle? That being the case, now let's understand what Yeshua prayed in John chapter 17. Yes. John 17, verse 21. I pray that they all may be one, as you, Father, art in me and I in thee, that they may be one in us. That the world will believe that you've sent me. I want you to notice, when he gathers his people, that is the exiles of Israel, that is the 12 tribes of Israel, and they become one, then the world will believe that you sent me. So not only is Yahweh Yeshua revealing himself to his people, but the world will know that you sent me. Egypt represents a type of the world and the world system. So not only is Yahweh making his name known to his people, but at the same time, Egypt will know that I am Yahweh when I stretch forth my hand and bring up the children of Israel from among them. And Moshe and Aaron did as Yahweh commanded them, so did they. And Moses was 80 years old and Aaron 83 when they spoke to Paro. Anybody now in the congregation with thoughts, questions, comments regarding these verses from our triennial Torah portion? Exodus chapter 6, verse 2 through chapter 7, in verse 7. Yes, Ron.
Yes, Eddie, in regards to what is taking place with the deliverance of the children of Israel out of Egypt, we have Moses being told to go down and to tell the people, and then going before Pharaoh. And at first the people were glad and they were grateful that Yahweh had looked upon their condition and was wanting to deliver them. And then Pharaoh says, who is Yahweh? I don't know him. And begins to put greater bondage upon the children of Israel, to the point where they're becoming discouraged and they're ready to reject Moses and Aaron. All right. I know you're talking about us being close to this period of time, the ends of days. We're already seeing the land of Israel being divided. We're seeing various things such as the Elijah message coming forth. How would you paint this scenario where we see this beast king who is, in the end times representative of what Pharaoh was at his point in time? Could you give us any kind of an idea of what it might look like for what we're coming into in this final quarter of time?
Well, I would say the same thing, that when the shofar is sounded for us to return to Zion, to the land, we will be opposed by the world and the world system. We will be opposed by the government of the United States, we'll be opposed by the government of Israel, will be opposed by the nations of the world, because the nations of the world are rallying behind trying to support the peace agreement made with the Palestinians, of which the return to the land and those who are returning to the land will be in rebellion against the Palestinian state that the nations have pledged to work to create. Now, it says in Jeremiah in chapter 50 regarding Babylon, it says the following. In verse 33, thus says Yahweh of hosts, the children of Israel and the children of Judah were oppressed together. All that took them captive held them fast and refused to let them go. That's the same thing that Pharaoh did. He refused to let them go. So, we will be seeing the borders being closed, and any who express an interest to return to the land of Zion will be hindered, and the world will try to make our lives harder and tougher, just like Pharaoh did. But then, even as Yahweh Yeshua pleaded the cause of his people with Pharaoh, it says, Jeremiah 50:34, their Redeemer is strong, Yahweh of hosts is his name. He will thoroughly plead their cause, that he may give rest and disquiet the inhabitants of Babylon. So basically, that which happened before is destined to happen again, because there's no new thing under the sun. Any other thoughts, questions, comments, Bill?
Just a couple little tidbits. Up here in 24, it talks about the sons of Korah. Now, was he the priest? Were they the priest of the line?
Korah was the guy that started
the... Okay, and he's the one that was killed. They were killed, were they not?
He's the one that they first opened up.
Okay, this Elkanah, the one noted here is Elkanah. If you go further into scriptures, into Samuel, and in Numbers 26, you'll see that he is a descendant of Samuel. I thought that was sort of interesting. And down here, when I was reading through this whole thing, it shows, and on verse 26, these are that Aaron and Moses. Now they have the names in reverse, what normally they would be by stature. But it dawned on me that Yahweh is one who has order, and it had to do with age here. He put him in the order of their age, and Aaron was older than him.
That could also be Moshe just being polite.
It could be, but Yahweh's the one that inspired it, because I think all of these people are basically pretty much in order. Their names are in order. I thought that was sort of interesting, that he is so precise in his dealings and his word, that he would even switch the names around of what you would normally think that they would have been.
Anybody else with thoughts, questions, comments, Tom?
Just a quick comment. When I see this portion here, I just think again of the sovereignty of Yahweh. Starting at verse 1, I know our portion starts at 2, but in verse 1 it's put so eloquently, "Now you shall see what I will do to Pharaoh, for under compulsion he will let them go, and under compulsion he will drive them out of his land." And then we see this story unfold. It's just like a play, and you can see that Yahweh is completely in control. I love it.
A couple of weeks ago, we were looking at, it was probably last week, we were looking at chapters 4 and 5, and in chapter 4, we saw Moses come up with three excuses why he was not fit to do what Yeshua asked him to do. Okay, the first one was in 4:1, where he said, they won't believe me. Okay? He says, what happens? They'll say that the Lord has not appeared unto you. And then in verse 10, "And Moshe said unto Yahweh, O Adonai, I am not eloquent, neither there heretofore, since thou hast spoken unto thy servant." He said, I don't speak very well. I'm stupid, is basically what he was saying. And then in verse 13, he says, "O Adonai, send, I pray thee, by the hand of him whom thou wilt send." Don't send me, send somebody else. Okay, in other words, I need help. I can't do this. So those are the first three excuses. Then we see excuses 4 and 5 here in chapter 6 and 7. In chapter 6, where the next excuse comes in verse 12 of chapter 6. "And Moshe spake unto Yahweh, saying, Behold, the children of Israel have not hearkened unto me. How then shall Pharaoh hear me, who am of uncircumcised lips?" He says, I'm a stutterer. He's not going to want to listen to me. Israel won't listen. There's no way Pharaoh is going to. And then the last one was in verse 30, where he said, I'm a stutterer. Pharaoh won't be patient enough to hear me. I'm of uncircumcised lips. How is he going to listen to me? So five times he's told Yahweh, I can't do this. It's not right. You know, you must have picked the wrong guy. But then in the next chapter, we start to see where Moshe is doing miracles by the hand of Yahweh. And all of a sudden, he doesn't give any more excuses. Okay? Just want to let you know, we all make excuses about how we can't do these things. Moshe did the same thing. He was the meekest man that ever lived, with the exception of Yeshua. So there's...
By the way, in some cases, the excuses can be legitimate through natural eyes. If you look at it through natural eyes, the excuses really are natural eye obstacles that the mind doesn't believe can be accomplished. So for a little bit of humor here, someone of old might have said the following: well, no. Was he stuttering? Well, no. Mr. Reagan!
That was a pretty good Reagan. You know, Reagan and Clint Eastwood, they're pretty much the same. Just Clint Eastwood's just a little bit deeper, okay? Reagan was more like, well, while Clint Eastwood is, well, okay? So it's just that... they're pretty much the same voice, though. But yeah, that's beautiful. Well.
Was he a good orator, or was he a stutter when he said,
well, well?
Well, no. It was actually... No. Actually, Reagan was a very good orator. And that was the one thing the boy had going for him.
So he wasn't stuttering when he said, no?
No.
Oh, okay. Just checking.
He was just thinking. He was thinking and just trying to make sure that you didn't jump in and derail his train of thought. That's what it was.
You know, some people thought he was the Antichrist, Ronald Wilson Reagan, 666. Okay. Back on track here. Anybody else? Thoughts, questions, comments regarding Exodus chapter 6, verse 2, verses chapter 7, and verse 7? Anybody? Okay, that means we're going to go on to the Brit Hadashah, to the Half Torah, Ezekiel in chapter 28, Ezekiel chapter 28 and verse 25, verses 29-21, here goes. Thus says Yahweh Elohim, when I shall have gathered the house of Israel from the people among whom they are scattered and shall be sanctified in them in the sight of the heathen. You see, he's talking about the future. And what does he say? I will be sanctified in them in the sight of the heathen, just like it says, and Pharaoh will know that I am Yahweh. Then shall they dwell in their land that I have given to my servant Jacob, and they will dwell safely therein. They shall build houses and plant vineyards, yea, they will dwell with confidence. When I have executed judgment upon all those that despise them round about. Who are all those that despise them round about? It's those who despise the covenant made with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And look at this. And they will know that I am Yahweh their Elohim. Once again, showing that the gathering of the 12 tribes of Israel is associated with Yeshua the Messiah revealing himself to his people and revealing his people that he is Yahweh and also revealing himself to the world. Notice we have these same principles. Now continuing on, Ezekiel 29 verse 1, in the 10th year, in the 10th month, on the 12th day of the month, the word of Yahweh came unto me, saying, Son of man, set your face against Paro, king of Egypt, and prophesy against him and against all Egypt. Speak and say, thus says Yahweh Elohim, behold, I am against you, Paro, king of Egypt, the great dragon that lies in the midst of the rivers, which has said, my river is my own, I have made it for myself, I will put hooks in your jaws. Now notice what's said about Pharaoh, is that hooks will be put in his jaws. This is parallel to Ezekiel in chapter 38 and verse 4, which says about the Gog-Magog coalition, I will turn you back and I will put hooks in your jaws. So therefore, what Yahweh did unto Pharaoh in Egypt is prophetic of what he will do to Gog and Magog and that coalition of forces. Notice Pharaoh is called a great dragon. Go.
Then is Gog and Magog the same entity as Pharaoh in the future here?
What do you mean by same entity?
What I'm saying is, we saw how he did that with Egypt. Okay, we saw how he did that with Egypt in the past. He's saying that he's going to do it to Egypt in the future. He also, that's in chapter 28 or 29. Then in chapter 38, he says he's going to do exactly the same thing to Gog and Magog. Is this the same? Is this happening at exactly the same time? Is he going to bring Pharaoh against Israel at the same time that he brings Gog and Magog against Israel? And I believe the answer to that is yes, if we look at Ezekiel 38.
I actually don't believe it's literally Pharaoh. I believe Pharaoh represents the leader of the Gog-Magog coalition, and the defeat in the future is likened to that which happened in the past. So using Pharaoh and Egypt is poetic language that historically was true, but it's connecting that which happened historically to the future, showing the comparison.
Okay. So it's not necessarily Egypt coming at the same time.
No, it's not literally Egypt. It's representing the system, you might say the beast system even, that opposes Zion.
What's really interesting is that in chapter 38, Egypt isn't even mentioned. But all the nations around Egypt are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Libya, Ethiopia, the African nations that border on Egypt. But Egypt isn't mentioned at all.
So it says, I will leave you thrown into the wilderness, you and all the fish of your rivers, and you will fall upon the open fields. This is also language that's associated with the defeat of Gog and Magog. It says, they will not be brought together nor gathered. I have given you for meat to the beasts of the field and to the fowls of the heaven. And all the inhabitants of Egypt will know that I am Yahweh, because they have been a staff of reed to the house of Israel. Well, if you look at Gog Magog, it goes on to say that it's going to take 7 months. The slaughter is going to be so great, it's going to take 7 months. In Ezekiel 39 verse 12, 7 months shall the house of Israel be barren of them, that they may cleanse the land. And so with it says in Ezekiel 39 verse 17, Son of man, thus says Yahweh Elohim, speak unto every feathered fowl and to every beast of the field, assemble yourselves and come, gather yourselves on every side to my sacrifice that I do sacrifice for you, even a great sacrifice upon the mountains of Israel, that you may eat flesh and drink blood. And you will eat the flesh of the mighty and drink the blood of the princes of the earth. So, what is described here in Ezekiel 29 about the prophecy of Pharaoh, it's in the context of the defeat of Gog and Magog, that the defeat of Pharaoh in Egypt is a prophetic foreshadowing of the defeat of Gog and Magog. And it says in verse 7 of Ezekiel 29, when they took hold of you by the hand, and you did break and rend all their shoulder, and when they leaned upon you, you did break and made all their loins to be extant. So notice it says that the children of Israel were leaning on Pharaoh, and it says that he's likened to a great dragon that lies in the midst of the rivers. Now if we go to the book of Job in chapter 41, it says the following: can you draw out Leviathan with a hook? Can you put a hook into his nose or bore his jaw through with a thorn? Will he make supplication with you? Will he speak soft words unto you? Will he make a covenant with you? It says in verse 34, he beholds all things, he is king over all the children of pride. So it says that a covenant is being made with a leviathan, and a hook is being put in the nose of leviathan. Well, in Psalm 74 and verse 13, it says, "You did divide the sea by your strength. You broke the heads of the dragons in the waters. You broke the heads of Leviathan and gave him to be meat to the people inhabiting the wilderness." Historically, it's talking about Pharaoh. But prophetically, it's talking about Gog and Magog. And when it says, verse 7, "When they took hold of you by your hand, you did break and rend all their shoulder, when they leaned upon you." Notice it says the children of Israel are leaning, trusting upon Pharaoh. That is a way of saying that they will put their hope and confidence in the signing of a peace agreement. That's putting their hope in Pharaoh, in the world system, and not putting their hope in the God of Israel, in Yeshua the Messiah, and not putting their hope in the Torah, in the covenant that was made with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Ezekiel 29 verse 8. "Therefore thus says Yahweh, I will bring a sword upon you and cut off man and beast out of you. And the land of Egypt will be desolate and waste, and they will know that I am Yahweh, because he said, the river is mine, I have made it." You see, if Gog and Magog, as some of the rabbis interpret it, if Gog refers to a leader, then this leader sees himself as, the river is mine, no one can stop me, what I decree to do will happen. And in verse 10 it says, "Behold, therefore I am against you and against your rivers, and I will make the land of Egypt utterly waste and desolate." It says, "From the tower of Cyrene, even to the border of Ethiopia, no foot of man shall pass through it, nor foot of beast shall pass through it, neither shall it be inhabited 40 years. And I will make the land of Egypt desolate in the midst of the countries that are desolate, and her cities among the cities that are laid waste shall be desolate 40 years. And I will scatter the Egyptians among the nations and will disperse them through the countries. Yet thus says Yahweh Elohim, at the end of 40 years will I gather the Egyptians from the people where they were scattered, and I will bring again the captivity of Egypt and cause them to return into the land of Pathros, under the land of their inhabitation, and they shall be there a base kingdom. It shall be the basis of the kingdoms, neither shall it exalt itself any more above the nations, for I will diminish them, that they shall no more rule over the nations. And it shall be no more the confidence of the house of Israel, which brings their iniquity to remembrance, when they shall look after them, but they will know that I am Yahweh, their Elohim. And it came to pass in the 27th year, in the first month, in the first day of the month, the word of Yahweh came unto me, saying, Son of man, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, caused his army to serve a great service against Tyrus. Every head was made bald, and every shoulder was peeled. Yet had he no wages, nor his army, for Tyrus, for the service that he had served against us. Therefore, thus says Yahweh Elohim, behold, I will give the land of Egypt unto Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and he will take her multitude and take her spoil and take her prey. Leave it go. And it shall be the wages for his army. I have given him the land of Egypt for your labors wherewith he served against me, because they wrought for me, says Yahweh Elohim. In that day will I cause the horn of the house of Israel to bud forth, and I will give you the opening of the mouth of the midst of them, and they will know that I am Yahweh. All right. thoughts, questions, comments in the congregation, or in Pow Talk Land? There's a question in Pow Talk. All these verses talk about Israel, not just the Jews. Will the other tribes have been recognized and allowed to return by this time? As currently you can only return if you are of the house of Judah, not if you are of the 10 lost tribes. Well, with the creation of the state of Zion is when the process will begin to gather all 12 tribes in the end of the exile will begin. There are two signs that are associated with this gathering of all 12 tribes. One is the birth of the state of Zion, which is a rebellion against the PLO state, and the other is the defeat of Gog and Magog upon the mountains of Israel. Anybody else? We are in Ezekiel chapter 29. Have thoughts, questions, comments that they would like to share regarding these scriptures? There's a very important principle which I've been communicating, and that is the defeat of Pharaoh and his army historically is a prophetic foreshadowing of the defeat of Gog and Magog in the end of days. Because in Zechariah in chapter 14, verse 3, it says, "Then shall Yahweh go forth and fight against the nations." That's fighting against the nations that divide Jerusalem. He will fight against them as he did in the day of battle, which is when Pharaoh and his army drowned in the Red Sea. What is the battle called where Yahweh, Jerusalem, Gog and Magog? And also it says he brings them in the valley of Jehoshaphat. That's the battle against the nations, and he will fight against them as he did in the day of battle. Mark.
I'm just answering my last question. It looks like Nebuchadnezzar, it says, "I have given Egypt for his labor, wherewith he served against." What happens in verse 19 of chapter 29? We see that Nebuchadnezzar took Tyre, and it cost him a lot of money. He lost money taking Tyre. It was their business. It was the king's business to go out and make war and take all kinds of spoil. That was how they earned money. Okay, and this, you know, it was like their big business venture, right? So he lost money taking Tyre, because the way he had to do it. I mean, he had to tear down cities and pile it up in the ocean for a mile.
That was a huge difference. What he basically did, he conquered the land of the city. They moved out to the seaport.
Wait, you're going to talk.
Grab a mic if you're going to talk.
All right. Well, I think what happened there is that he'd actually conquered the landed city of Tyre, but what they did is they moved out to their sea island, and it was later that Alexander came and basically took all the ruins of the landed city and dumped them in.
But he's at, because it cost him to take Tyre, Yahweh gave him an easier target, and that easier target was Egypt. Okay, so he went right down the seacoast and he took Egypt out. Perhaps that's what we're going to see in the near future, if we are correct in thinking that America has become the new Babylon. And therefore the leader of America is the new Nebuchadnezzar. Then when he comes through Assyria and thereby makes himself also the Assyrian, when he comes through Assyria and takes and goes down, and he takes Egypt right out of the picture, and now he's got the Gog and Magog thing with all of those surrounding countries. He wipes out Egypt, and all those other surrounding countries decide that they're going to ally themselves with him and attack Israel along with Gog and Magog. That's just something that I'm trying to formulate in my brain here in the last couple of minutes.
I think it's interesting as far as the text of Ezekiel, the way in which we have Ezekiel chapter 28, it talks about the king of Tyre, and he's pictured as a type of the adversary of Satan, of Lucifer. And then we have, in chapter 29, we have the discussion of what's going on in Egypt, and different points in time, the Pharaoh is pictured as a type, via Leviathan, as a type of the adversary. And then we have Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, and the king of Babylon in Isaiah 14 is also seen as a type of adversary, and he comes down, and first he conquers Tyre, and then he conquers Egypt. And it kind of, if you follow Daniel, it talks about this one who comes down out of the north, and says he will go into the land of Egypt in the last days, and he'll discover the hidden treasures that are there in Egypt. And so there is something about going down by this adversarial type figure into the land of Egypt to do a tremendous amount of conquering. And it'll, at that point when he does go into Egypt, he will be able to gain a great amount of wealth, because he'll be able to obtain these wealth, these hidden treasures that are there.
Go ahead.
We have a question on Pow Talk. In Revelation, it speaks, I believe it's Revelation chapter 16. It says, let's see if it's Revelation 16. Well, anyhow, the question is, in Revelation, it speaks of angels being bound at the Euphrates, and that these angels are set apart in the end of time. They'll be loosed out of various acts. Do you believe that this is what has already happened in Iraq, and that these angels already have been loosed? And does that account for what is happening in the Middle East now? Well, I believe what's happening in the Middle East now is a part of the beginning of the whole conflict of the end of days, which ultimately I believe is associated ultimately with these prophecies in the book of Revelation, and specifically Revelation chapter 16 and verse 12. And so I do believe I do believe it has a role to play in the ultimate bigger picture. If you don't, if you have the advantage of looking back and saying, you know, history has the advantage of looking back and showing cause and effect, which ultimately can take years to show the cause and effect. And so I believe that which is started in Iraq now is ultimately, time will show that it ultimately has a cause and effect connection to all these prophecies of the end of days, and will have a connection, I believe, ultimately with the one here about the River Euphrates. Anyone else have thoughts, questions, comments? See, in Daniel in chapter 12, we're told that there was a conflict between good and evil in the end of days, wherein it says, "And at that time shall Michael stand up, the great prince which stands for the children of your people. There will be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation, even to the same time. And at that time shall your people be delivered, everyone that's found written in the book." So it says Michael shall stand up. So Michael is the defender, is a defender of the nation of Israel. Specifically, he's the defender of Zion. In Revelation chapter 12, verse 7, says there was war in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon fought in his angels. So if you look at the context of the dragon and his angels, it's associated with this beast having seven heads and ten horns and seven crowns that's fighting against the woman and the woman who's given birth to a man-child. That's the real battle that's being waged. And the angel that's fighting for the woman who's bringing forth the man-child is Michael. And we have the angels of HaSatan, who's fighting on behalf of the beast system, against the woman who is being born and given birth to the man-child. So we have this conflict that's taking place here in the end of days. We have a question. Do you think Kosovo's independence will be a hook in the jaw of Gog-Magog countries? Russia is very upset about this. Personally, I think the answer is no. I think the hook, I think Gog and Magog, since the battle is upon the mountains of Israel, the hook is that coalition is coming to enforce the peace agreement that has been signed and to kick Jews out of their homes in the mountains of Israel. I believe that is the hook. It's to enforce a signed peace agreement. Go ahead.
Just thinking about what was being shared in Ezekiel 29 about the Pharaoh being like the monster who lies in the sea and having scales and saying the river is mine, and just getting a picture of Moses being drawn out of the midst of the river. Just a thought about Moses being the representation of Yahweh's word, and how the word is that which divides between joint and marrow, and just separates. And so even though Pharaoh had control over, you know, everything in Egypt, Yahweh used him as a type to represent that his word would divide. And so Moses was raised up in the midst of all that turmoil to bring Yahweh's word and ultimately deliverance.
Also, he's drawn out of the water. If the water in this case has got to represent the world and the world system, it's weird to come out of the world, drawn out of the world, even as Abraham came out of Ur of the Chaldees. Anybody else? Thoughts, questions, comments in the congregation or in Pal-Talk land? You have a thought, Mark? Okay. Let's go then to Isaiah 42, verse 8. That can't be too complicated.
Exile and redemption.
No, Isaiah 42, verse 8. I am Yahweh, that is my name, and my glory will I not give to another, neither my praise to graven images. You know, this is a very important principle that about 99% of people in ministry don't understand. Leaders in ministry have a great tendency to think of themselves and what they know and who they're leading, that they think of themselves as being special. And they, for the most part, aren't willing to submit themselves to give glory to Yahweh, Yeshua, and above all things lift Him up, rather than speaking about Him and giving insights of Him, wherein they get praised for their knowledge and understanding and their oratory skills, but rather we need to remember that Yahweh will not give his glory to another. And so when we are up there, we need to remember that we are representing, we're a representative, we're an ambassador of Yahweh and of his kingdom. He's only just using us, and we need to remember to ultimately direct and allow glory to be given to him. Anybody else with thoughts, questions, comments regarding this verse? Well, how about Psalm 44? We have a question on Pal Talk. In preparation for the return of the 10 tribes of Israel, should we be preparing to go to Jerusalem to meet at the Feast of Shavuot for the next few years? What we need to be doing is we need to be watching for the signs that are going to trigger these things, which ultimately is a peace agreement to create a Palestinian state. We should be watching and preparing and anticipating for that event to happen. That will trigger the other events. Ultimately, the rebellion against the Palestinian state, which is the creation of the state of Zion, and that triggers our return to the land, of which Jerusalem is only one of several destinations when we go back to the land.
Having said that, though, whoever wrote that question is correct, in that if we're keeping Torah correctly, then three times a year we are commanded to go up to Jerusalem. We should be, if we're going to do it correctly, which I don't know anybody who really is, I'm not saying they're not out there, I just don't know them. I'm sure somebody's got to be doing it. Pesach, Shavuot, Sukkot, they would be in Jerusalem keeping those feasts. So should we be doing that in light of what's going on? No. Should we be doing it because it's his word? Absolutely. Because what goes on or doesn't go on doesn't change his word.
Okay, Psalm 44, verse 1. We have heard with our ears, O Elohim, our fathers have told us, what work you did in their days in the times of old. Of course, this is speaking about the redemption from Egypt. How you did drive out the heathen with your hand and planted them. How you did afflict the people and cast them out. For they got not the land in possession by their own sword, neither did their own arm save them. But your right hand and your arm and the light of your countenance, because you had favor upon them. You are my king, O Elohim. Command deliverances for Jacob. Notice the one that's king in Elohim is the one that delivered his people with his right hand and his arm. Through you, we will push down our enemies. Through your name, we will tread them under that rise up against us. For I will not trust in my bow, neither shall my sword save me. But you have saved us from our enemies and have put them to shame that hated us. In Elohim we boast all the day long and praise your name forever, Selah. But you have cast off and put us to shame, and you go not forth with our armies. So here we're being told that Yahweh Elohim has cast his people off, which means sent them into exile. Who is the one that cast off and sent his people into exile? Jeremiah 31 verse 10. Hear the word of Yahweh, all ye nations, and declare it in the isles afar off, and say, he that scattered Israel will gather him in his keeping as a shepherd does his flock. The good shepherd of Israel is going to gather the sheep of Israel. But the good shepherd of Israel, that is the Messiah, is also the one that scattered Israel. And in his people being exiled in the nations of the world, the nations of the world have tormented and have ruled over his people in exile. Psalm 44, verse 10, you make us to turn back from the enemy, and they which hate us spoil for themselves. You have given us like sheep appointed for meat, and you've scattered us among the heathen. You sell your people for naught, and you do not increase by their price. You make us a reproach to our neighbors, a scorn and a derision to them that are round about us. You make us a byword among the heathen, a shaking of the head among the people. So this is describing the curse of exile. In Psalm 14, you made us a byword among the nations. This is actually the prophecy that's found in Deuteronomy in chapter 28. Verse 15, my confusion is continually before me, and the shame of my face has covered me. For the voice of him that reproaches and blasphemes by reason of the enemy and avenger, all this has come upon us, yet have we not forgotten you, neither have we dealt falsely in your covenant. Our heart is not turned back, neither have our steps declined from your way. Though you have sore broken us in the place of dragons and covered us with the shadow of death, if we have forgotten the name of our God or stretched out our hands to a strange God, shall not God search this out? For he knows the secrets of the heart. Yea, for your sake are we killed all the day long. We are counted as sheep for the slaughter. Notice here the exiles of Israel are regarded as sheep going to the slaughter. And Yeshua also is regarded as being like a sheep going to the slaughter. In the book of Acts, in the book of Acts, this about Yeshua and Isaiah chapter 53, in Acts chapter 8, verse 32, the place of the scripture which he read was this: he was led as a sheep to the slaughter, and like a lamb dumb before his shearer, so he opened not his mouth. Verse 35, then Philip opened his mouth and began at the same scripture and preached Yeshua. Notice that Yeshua is a lamb that is likened to going to a slaughter, but his people are also in exile, likened to the sheep that's going to the slaughter. So we have the principle, what happens to Yeshua happens to Israel, what happens to Israel happens to Yeshua, because they are one with each other, they are in covenant relationship with each other. Psalm 44:23, awake you sleep thou, O Yahweh, arise, cast us not off forever. Wherefore hide your face and forget our affliction and our oppression? For our soul is bowed down to the dust, our belly cleaves to the earth. Arise for our help and redeem us for your mercy's sake. Notice the one that scattered the exiles of Israel. It says in Psalm 44, verse 24, that he's hiding his face. In Isaiah, in chapter 54, in Isaiah in chapter 54, and verse 8, it says, in a little wrath I hid my face from you for a moment, but with everlasting kindness will I have mercy on you, says Yahweh your Redeemer. Notice it's Yahweh your Redeemer that hides his face. It's Yahweh your Redeemer who sent his people into exile. Who is Yahweh your Redeemer? It's Yeshua the Messiah. And it says, with great mercies I will gather you. So the prayer in Psalm 44, verse 26, arise for our help and redeem us for your mercy's sake. He said he will redeem his people and do it with great mercies being shown upon his people. Ron.
Yes, there's an irony that I noticed when I was in Israel in Jerusalem on the Temple Mount, and there was the Western Wall on one side, and then where the temple used to be and the way in which the direction of the temple would face towards the Mount of Olives, he would be facing, that would be the presence of Yahweh, would be facing towards the east, towards the Mount of Olives. And they would be there praying and weeping at the Western Wall. And there they are down there with their faces against there, looking in the direction of the temple, over the Temple Mount. And his back would be to them. But if you were to look further and you would go to Mount of Olives, where I believe, of course, Messiah was crucified, that it was there that his face was looking towards the actual temple area. And so what happens is that we have this illustration of them being cut off from being able to see his face because where they are positionally. But in his mercy, when Yahweh Yeshua returns and his feet come down on the Mount of Olives, he's going to split that from north to south and create a great valley going right into the temple area and probably dividing that Western Wall, and they'll be looking, and there he will be. There will be no longer any obstruction any longer. His face will no longer be hidden. He will create a clear valley for them to be able to see him and his presence, and he will then provide a way for them to flee into a place of safety and security. And so this is the condition that they are now in, and there's an accurate portrayal going on every day as they go to the Western Wall and they insert their prayers into the cracks and they implore his intervention on their behalf. And we pray that it would be soon.
In verses 4 through 8, we have this great declaration of how we trust Yahweh. Okay, let me read that. Thou art my king, O Elohim. Command deliverances for Yaakov. Through thee will we push down our enemies. Through thy name will we tread them under that rise up against us. For I will not trust in my bow, neither shall my sword save me. But thou hast saved us from our enemies, and hast put them to shame that hated us. In Elohim we boast all the day long, and praise thy name forever. Selah. Then in verse 9, next breath, it says, But thou hast cast us off, and put us to shame, and goest not forth with our armies. If all of the stuff from verses 4 through 8 is true, how can verse 9 be true? Okay? If they're really putting their trust in Yahweh, he will deliver them. So they must not really be putting their trust in Yahweh, and this whole five verses must all be show, and only outward show.
17 through 22 is the same thing.
17 through 22 is the same thing?
It never happened.
Right. And however, at the end of the psalm, we do have our deliverance.
Right.
Okay? The fact is that we need to repent of the outward show, okay, and actually, really and truly have our hearts set on Yahweh. Then he'll deliver us. You know, all the outward show in the world is going to do us no good whatsoever. And that, I think, is the gist of this whole thing, and that's what David's trying to get across to us.
Anybody else? Thoughts, questions, comments, Ron?
I'm just going to key off what Mark was just saying. At verse 8, where there's a point or a break, there's the word silah, which means there's a crescendo of this particular thought. And so it was, I would say, during the period of time of the kings, where you'd have a king that would be righteous and serve Yahweh, and like Jehoshaphat, and how there was a great deliverance where they were able to see their adversaries completely obliterated. But then, you know, one or two kings later, they're back into doing dishonorable things. And so we see this kind of like the tide going in and out, in and out. Once they're serving him and then falling back. So that's why I believe what Bill was saying in verse 17, because we've forgotten thee. And so there's the answer to this, so the problem and the solution is that they need to continue to walk in a way that's going to show that they truly have confidence and faith by the way that they live. And that way Yahweh Elohim will honor them. And as a result of that, they will be able to continue to have victory over their enemies.
Part of the problem that we have today as well as what they had back. You know, we can look back and say, oh, how could it be that stupid? How could they do such things like that? You know, the word is given forward to them and the prophets were there.
Yeah, hey.
but we as a people have basically the whole counsel of Yahweh here written down. And yet we still don't stop and consider. The biggest problem I see here is probably the same problem we have, is we don't look in the mirror. We don't look in the mirror and see that, you know what? All this came about because it's our fault. You see, Yahweh had it right when he told the priests to go and wash themselves in the laver, which was the looking glass. So when they looked down, or who did they see first? That they had to get the sins washed away. Themselves. They had to consider themselves before they could do any repentance for the nation. They had to come and clean themselves up first. But excuses will not fly with Yahweh. He's not looking for excuses. He's looking for people that would execute for them.
James chapter 1, verse 22 and following, it says this: But be ye doers of the word and not hearers only, deceiving your own selves. For if any man be a hearer of the word and not a doer, he is like unto a man beholding his natural face in a glass. For he beholdeth himself and goeth his way, and straightforward forgetteth what manner of man he was. But whoso looketh into the perfect law of liberty, that's Torah, and continueth therein, he being not a forgetful hearer, but a doer of the work, this man shall be blessed in his deed. Okay? Exactly. There's the mirror that we're to look in and see how it applies to us. And when we see how it applies to us, we are to repent humbly and ask Yahweh to deliver, and he will do so.
Anybody else with thoughts, questions, comments? Psalm 44, anybody else? Okay, let's go to the Brit Hadashah. First is 3 John, verses 1 through 8. It says, The outrun of the well-beloved Gaius, whom I love in the truth. Beloved, I wish above all things that you would prosper and be in health, even as your soul prospers. But I rejoice greatly when the brethren came and testified of the truth that is in you, even as you walk in the truth. I have no greater joy than to hear that my children walk in the truth. Notice he's delighted to hear that they're walking in the truth. What is the truth? Psalm 119 verses 142, Thy righteousness is an everlasting righteousness, and your Torah is truth. Psalm 119 verse 151, All your commandments are truth. So John is rejoicing hearing of somebody that's walking and following Torah. Beloved, you do faithfully whatsoever you do to the brethren and to the strangers, which have borne witness of the love before the church, whom if you bring forward on their journey after godly sort, they shall do well, because that for his name's sake they went forth taking nothing of the Gentiles. Anything else that anyone would like to further add? Only went through 7? Okay, verse 8 says, We therefore ought to receive such that we might be fellow helpers to the truth.
Okay, now, if I may.
Go ahead.
I'm gonna do a synopsis of this thing, what this thing says to me, the whole chapter. The main theme here seems to be the receipt of missionaries and carrying them on with support, and the manner of doing so. John deals with the issue of the growing trend among the Gentile believers to despise and reject Jewish believers. A faction of Gentiles led by Diotrephes in verse 9 has usurped authority and is not allowing anyone of Jewish descent to teach, and they've remade the veil, the wall of partition that Messiah had destroyed. It seems they didn't want to be one in Messiah, but wanted to create a church of their own that didn't accept Jews. And that's what John is fighting with this short letter. Okay? So if we keep that in mind while we're looking at these verses, then we'll have an idea of what's going on. So Diotrephes was a bad dude. Yeah, he wanted complete control. He wanted to be the pastor and the CEO all at once. Boy, that doesn't sound anything like the modern church, does it?
I think and he was going against Scripture, because I think in Corinthians it talks about if a brethren has a fault and you take the brethren and he refuses to repent, that's the only way that you can cast him out of the fellowship. But that is not what was being done here. See, that's not what was being done here. And the key talks about is to walk in the truth. If you have a tolerance for sin, it's sin. In other words, it's like a cancerous sore. How many of you have had apples? You had a bad one in there, and all of a sudden it gets and touches another one, it gets rotten. It's just like a cancer. It continues to rot and to go on. And he's trying to tell him here what the wrong, you know, in truth. What is truth? It's Torah. Truth is Torah. Follow Torah. That's what he's talking about here. As we walk, the key is as we walk in truth, as Yahweh's Yeshua said, then we will have a good report to the glory of Him, not to the glory of ourselves.
Anybody else?
Yeah, I like the use in verse 5. Whatsoever thou doest to the brethren and to strangers. Okay. Gaius, the guy that this was actually written to, this letter, must have been somebody who was used to being hospitable to the missionaries that came through. He's the guy who would take people into his own home and house them and help them do whatever they needed to do in order so they could carry out their mission. And so that's the reason that this whole thing, he was one given to hospitality, who loved to help along the brethren in carrying forth the gospel. The strangers that are talked about in verse 5 are obviously the Gentile believers, and the brethren would be the Jewish believers. Okay? That's the way I read it anyway.
Anybody else with thoughts, questions, comments? Okay, let's go to Revelation chapter 3, verses 7 through 13, which is what is said to the church at Philadelphia. To the angel of the church at Philadelphia write, these things says he that is holy, he that is true, he that has the key of David. First of all, what is the key of David? I believe the key of David is a love for the Torah. He that opens and no man shuts, and shuts and no man opens. I know your works. Behold, I have set before you an open door, and no man can shut it. Notice that when Yeshua gives us an open door, no man has the authority and power to shut it. For you have a little strength, and you have kept my word, and you have not denied my name. If he's kept my word, what are they doing? They're following Torah. Behold, I will make them of the synagogue of Satan, which say they are Jews and are not, but do lie. Behold, I will make them to come and worship before your feet to know that I have loved you. So this is really a play of words. Those of the synagogue of Satan. Satan here means the accuser of the brother. I will make those who are accuser of the brothers who say they are Jews, which means praisers of God. See, accusers of the brethren are not true praisers of God. I will make them to come into worship before your feet to know that I have loved you. Now, This is also a quote from Isaiah 49:23 and Isaiah 60 verse 14. So first, Isaiah in chapter 49 and verse 23. Says in verse 22, thus says Yahweh Elohim, behold, I will lift up my hand to the Gentiles and set up my standard to the people, and they will bring your sons in their arms, and your daughters shall be carried upon their shoulders. And the kings shall be your nursing fathers, and their queens your nursing mothers. They shall bow down to you with their face toward the earth and lick up the dust of your feet, and they will know that I am Yahweh. For they shall not be ashamed that wait for me. And then Isaiah chapter 60 verse 14, which says, the sons also of those that afflicted you will come bending unto you, and all that despise you shall bow themselves down at the soles of your feet, and they will call you the city of Yahweh, the Zion of the Holy One of Israel. Now, back to Revelation 3:10. Because you've kept the word of my patience, I will keep you from the hour of temptation which will come upon all the world to try them that dwell upon the earth. Behold, I come quickly. Hold that fast which you have, that no man take your crown. Him that overcomes will I make him a pillar in the temple of my God, and he shall go no more out. And I will write upon him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, which is the New Jerusalem, which comes down out of heaven from my God. And I will write upon him my new name. He that has a ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. Okay, anybody... Congregation or Pal Talk, have thoughts, questions, comments? Bill?
Well, there's a lot there, but the one thing I think I'd mention, this was basically quote, the perfect church, the one that kept Torah, the one that did things right, the one of brotherly love and so forth. But in the midst of all this, he says, there's going to be temptations and trials and tribulation. Apparently, this church is not out of here. This church is still here.
Oh, now wait a minute. Now wait just a minute, Bill. I was always taught that it says that I'm going to be made a pillar of the temple of my God, and therefore I can't be left here in that tribulation. I'm overcoming, and I become a pillar in the temple of my God, mm-hmm. which comes down out of heaven.
Well, yeah, I know. Yeah,
that's what it says there.
Can I tell you something? If you're going to be a pillar, and there's a whole lot of shaking going
Devil's
on,
advocate
that
here.
Means that you are going to be one that stands. You are going to be one that stands. So you will be the pillar. You'll be the strength. You'll be the strength of that. And that's what we're supposed to be, pillars, to stand up. And in all this, that's one of the things I see. There's a lot here, but I see that.
Well, we can be pillars, but if we're grabbers, we're probably millers rather than pillars.
Okay, in regards to making him a key, the house of David, in Isaiah chapter 22 and verse 22, it talks about how Isaiah's speaking of Shibna, who is in charge of the royal household, how his charge or his place is going to be taken and given to Eliakim, who is the son of Hilkiah, who is the priest, and that this is what was said of him, that this would be given to Eliakim, who would be a type. Then I will set the key of the house of David on his shoulder, and when he opens, no one will shut, and when he shuts, no one will open. And I'll keep reading. And I will drive him like a pig in a firm place, and he will become a throne of glory to his father's house. So they will hang on him all the glory of his father's house, offspring and issue, all the least of the vessels, from the bowls to all the jars. And in that day, declares Yahweh of hosts, the peg driven in a firm place, which is the Vav, of course, will give way, or even break off, and fall, and the load hanging on it will be cut off, for Yahweh has spoken. And what I see is that Yeshua will become this this peg, and on him rests the key of the house of David, even though Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, was to be a type of that. So there we see another application of where Revelation draws from the Old Testament, many scriptures.
Verse 12, I love this. Him that overcometh will I make a pillar in the temple of my God, and he shall go no more out, and I will write upon him three things: the name of my God, the name of the city of my God, and my new name. So Yeshua is going to write our own, the name of his God, the city of his God, and his own new name. That's pretty cool. Okay? That is really pretty cool. That's all I've got for that right now. Philadelphian Church Overcomers, three names they get, the Philadelphian Overcomers get. That's what I've got in mind.
Anybody else with thoughts, questions, comments? We are looking at Revelation chapter 3, verses 7 through 13, which is what is written to the congregation in Philadelphia, which is located in what's called Asia Minor. Okay, anybody else? Thoughts, questions, comments regarding these verses? Well, thematically, what's connected with verse 12, which I believe is why we have this included as well, Revelation 14:1, and I looked, and lo, a lamb stood on Mount Zion with him 144,000, having his father's name written in their forehead. So we see here the writing of a new name, the name of my God.
Another name.
Writing the name, having the father's name written on their forehead. So what is this thematically talking about? That he's writing his name on our forehead.
Marriage. They've taken the name of Yahweh on them.
Because the exile is associated, and the redemption from exile is associated with marriage. And so when you get married, you take the name of the bridegroom. So we are taking upon us the name of Yahweh. And the name represents a character, a destiny. And so having the Father's name is knowing the Father's character. Having an intimate relationship with the Father through Yeshua. And who ultimately is that? That is the bride. And the domain of the bride is the New Jerusalem, which is the inheritance of those who have Yahweh's name written upon their forehead. They're on Mount Zion. Mount Zion is Jerusalem.
Cross-reference I have to 14:1 is Psalm 27:5. For in the time of trouble he shall hide me in his pavilion. In the secret of his tabernacle shall he hide me, and he shall set me up upon a rock. I think that's what we're talking about. This is the rock here is Mount Zion, the Mount Zion. And the rock is also the Messiah who we're following. Okay? And he's hiding us in the time of trouble in that mount. Yeah, don't knock the rock, Bill says. I'm going to go over and knock him on his head.
Question on Pal Talk. Take the husband's name. As we are already betrothed, are two of the names already written and we are just waiting for the final marriage? You see, when we say yes to Yeshua and accept him as the Messiah and making him our Lord and Savior, we, by saying yes, have accepted a betrothal offer. We are required to be faithful. And in being faithful, he will ultimately come and consummate the marriage with us, which is him returning at his second coming, redeeming Zion and setting up his kingdom, wherein we rule and reign with him. Anybody else with thoughts, questions, comments regarding our portion in Revelation? If not, I would like to thank those of you in Pal Talk Land who have been a part of our Midrash and discussion on these scriptures. Pray insightful and helpful to you in helping you to learn and grow in a greater measure of Yeshua in the ways of the kingdom of Yahweh. Until we do it again, Shalom in Yeshua the Messiah. Amen.